Chapter 16. No sign of life, Grimes stared at the crumbling village of Asalar. Not even a dog or a goat.
Certainly looks dead, said Eva, shielding her eyes against the sun.
Deader than a flattened toad on a highway, Hopper muttered as he peered through a pair of binoculars. They stood on a small rise of rocky desert overlooking Asalar. The only evidence of humans were tire tracks that led into the village from the northeast. Strangely, none appeared to indicate a departure. Eva had the impression of an abandoned city of ancient times as she stared through the heat waves at the ruins surrounding the central part of town. There was an eerie silence about the place that made her feel tense and uneasy. Hopper turned to Batuta.
Kind of you to cooperate with us, Captain, and allow us to land here, but it's obvious the village is a deserted ghost town.
Batuta sat behind the wheel of the open Mercedes four-wheel drive and shrugged innocently.
A caravan from the salt mines at Tau Deni reported sickness in Asalar. What else can I tell you?
Won't hurt to have a look, said Grimes.
Eva nodded in agreement. We should analyze the water from the well to be on the safe side.
If you please walk in from here, said Batuta, I'll return to the aircraft and transport the rest of your people.
That's good of you, Captain, acknowledged Hopper. You can ferry our equipment as well. Without a reply or a wave, Batuta spun away in a cloud of dust and headed across a scrubby plain toward the parked aircraft that had landed on a long stretch of flat ground.
Damned odd of him to suddenly become helpful, muttered Grimes.
Eva nodded.
Too helpful, if you ask me. I don't much care for it, said Grimes, gazing at the silent village. If this was an American Western movie, I'd say we were walking into an ambush.
Ambush or not, said Hopper, unconcerned, let's give a go at finding any inhabitants. He set off down the slope in long strides, seemingly oblivious to the noonday sun and the heat radiating from the rock-strewn ground. Eva and Grimes hesitated a moment and then set off after him. 10 minutes later they entered the narrow, alley-like streets of Asalar. The narrow thoroughfares showed anything but a concern for neatness. They had to step over and around small mounds of trash and scattered rubbish that seemed to litter every square meter of ground. A light, hot breeze suddenly shifted, and the smell of decay and rotting meat struck their nostrils. The ugly odor grew more powerful with every step they took. It seemed to be drifting from inside the houses. Hopper refrained from entering any buildings until they reached the marketplace. Here, an incredibly disgusting sight met their eyes. None of them, in their wildest flights of nightmarish imagination, could have envisioned the horror. Scattered remains of human skeletons, skulls lined up as if displayed for sale, blackened and dried skin hanging from the tree in the market square that seemed alive under the attack of swarms of flies. Eva's first thought was that she was gazing at the human debris of some massacre by an armed force. But that theory was quickly discarded in her mind, as it didn't explain the positioning of the skulls or the flayed skin. Something happened here that went far beyond atrocities committed by bloodthirsty soldiers or desert bandits. That much became apparent when she knelt down and picked up a bone, recognizing it as a humerus, the long bone of the upper arm. A chill coursed through her blood as she discovered that it was indented and chipped by what she correctly identified as human teeth marks.
Cannibalism, she whispered in shock.
For some reason, the buzzing of the flies and the revelation uttered by Eva only served to heighten the deathly stillness of the village. Grimes gently took the bone from her hand and studied it.
She's right, he said to Hopper. Some bestial maniacs have eaten all these poor devils.
Judging from the stink, said Hopper, wrinkling his nose, there's still some who haven't turned to skeletons yet. You and Eva wait here. I'll check the houses and see if I can find a live one.
Doesn't look to me like they take to strangers, Grimes resisted. I suggest we beat a hasty retreat back to the plane before we wind up on the local menu.
Nonsense, Hopper scoffed. We're looking at an extreme case of abnormal behavior. It might very well be caused by the toxic contaminant we're searching for, and I'm not about to run away until I get to the bottom of it.
I'll go with you, Eva said resolutely.
Grimes shrugged. He was from the old school and not about to be outbraved by a woman.
All right, we'll search together.
Hopper slapped him on the back.
Good show, Grimes. I'd be honored to be an ingredient with you in the same soup du jour. The first house they entered, the walls little more than stacked rocks held together with dried mud, contained two bodies, a man and a woman, dead at least a week, the heat already having dried out their tissue and shriveled and tightened their skin. Death had not been swift, but agonizingly slow, Harper determined after a cursory examination of the shocking remains. Theirs had not been the death of a fast-acting poison. It had been the death of people who suffered excruciating torment until they were released.
"Can't tell much without a pathological examination," said Hopper.
Grimes looked down, his face calm and unperturbed.
"These people have been dead for some time. I'd stand a better chance of finding solid answers from a fresh victim."
It sounded so cold and clinical to Eva. She shuddered, not from the cadavers, but from recognizing a pile of small bones and skulls heaped in one corner of the darkened house. She could not help wondering if the couple had killed and eaten the flesh of their own children. The thought was too abhorrent to dwell on, and she pushed it aside and struck out on her own, entering a house directly across the street. She moved through a doorway that was more elaborate than the others. Beyond, there was an L-shaped courtyard that was clean and swept, almost blasphemous as compared to the others that were filled with debris. The stench was particularly strong in this house. Eva dampened a small handkerchief with water from a canteen on her belt, then stepped cautiously from room to room. The walls were a chalky white and the ceilings high with exposed, rounded poles laid over a matting. There was plenty of light from numerous windows all opening onto the courtyard. It was one of the grander houses of the town, probably belonging to a merchant, Eva judged from the crafted chairs and tables that had somehow managed to remain upright in normal positions, unlike the furnishings in other houses that were tossed about and broken. She slowly edged around a doorway into a large rectangular room. She gasped and stood there, rooted in disgust at finding a grisly pile of rotting human limbs neatly stacked in what was the kitchen. Eva fought back the rising sickness, suddenly feeling drained and empty and frightened. She fled from the hideous sight and stumbled into a bedroom. Shock piled on top of shock. She froze and stared at a man lying on a bed as if relaxing, his eyes wide open. His head was propped up on a cushion and his hands were stretched at his side, palms up. He stared back at her through sightless eyes that might have been on loan from the devil. The whites of the eyes were a bright pinkish color, while the irises were a deep red. For a frightful instant she thought he was still alive. But there was no rise in his chest from breathing, and his satanic-colored eyes never blinked. Eva stood there, staring back for what seemed a long time. Finally, she mustered up her courage and walked over to the bed and touched the carotid artery in his neck with the tips of her fingers. There was no pulse. She leaned over and lifted his arm. Rigor mortis had barely stiffened his muscles. She straightened as she heard footsteps behind her. She whirled around and saw Hopper and Grimes. They moved around her and looked down at the corpse. Then, abruptly, Hopper laughed, the sound booming throughout the house. "By God, Grimes, you wanted a fresh victim for an autopsy, and there it lies." After Batuta made the last trip into the village with the UN investigation team and their portable analysis equipment, he parked the Mercedes beside the aircraft. The inside of the cockpit and passenger cabin had quickly become an oven under the onslaught of the sun, and the crew was lounging in the shade under one wing. Though they had acted indifferent around the scientists when Batuta was present, they now came to attention and saluted him. "Anyone left in the plane?" Batuta asked. The chief pilot shook his head. "You took the last of them to the village. The aircraft is empty." Batuta smiled at the pilot, who wore an airline uniform with stripes on the sleeve.
"A fine piece of acting, Lieutenant Gemma. Dr. Hopper took the bait. You fooled him completely into thinking you were a substitute crew."
"Thank you, Captain, and thank my South African mother for teaching me English. I must use the radio to contact Colonel Mansa.
If you will come to the cockpit, I will set the frequency for you."
Stepping into the aircraft cockpit was like stepping into a bucket of molten lead. Though Lieutenant Gemma left the side windows open for ventilation, the heat still sucked the breath from Batuta.
He sat and suffered while the disguised Malian Air Force pilot hailed Colonel Mance's headquarters. Once contact was made, Jama turned over the microphone to Batuta and thankfully left the steamy cockpit.
"This is Falcon 1, over."
"I'm here, Captain," came the familiar voice of Mance. "You can dispense with the code. I doubt if enemy agents are listening in. What is your situation?"
"The natives of Asalar are all dead. The Westerners are operating freely in the village. I repeat, all the villagers are dead."
"Those bloody cannibals killed themselves off, did they?"
"Yes, Colonel, down to the last woman and child. Dr. Hopper and his people believe everyone was poisoned."
"Do they have proof?"
"Not yet. They're analyzing the water from the well and performing autopsies on the victims now."
"No matter. Play along with them. As soon as they've finished with their little experiments, fly them to Tabeza. General Kazim has arranged a welcoming committee." Batuta could well imagine what the general had planned for Hopper. He detested the big Canadian. He detested them all.
"I shall see they arrive in sound shape."
"Accomplish your mission, Captain, and I can safely promise you a promotion."
"Thank you, Colonel. Over and out."
Grimes set up shop in the house of the dead man Eva had discovered. It was the largest and cleanest of any building in the village. He performed pathology on the corpse found in the bedroom while Eva carried out blood tests. Hopper did chemical analysis of several wells that produced the town's meager water supply. The other members of the team began analyzing tissue and bone samples from a random selection of the dead. In one large storage house behind the market center, they found the trashed Land Rovers from the safari whose members had been massacred. They put the vehicles into service, shuttling supplies back and forth between the village and the aircraft, while Captain Batuta wandered about, making himself generally useless. The stench of the dead was too overpowering for sleep, so they worked through the night and into the next evening before taking a break. Camp was set up around the aircraft. After a brief sleep, dinner of packaged condensed beef stew, the World Health Team sat around an oil heater to ward off the 60-degree drop in temperature from the desert's daily high of 44 degrees centigrade, 111 degrees Fahrenheit. Batuta played congenial host and brewed them a pungent African tea, listening intently while everyone relaxed and compared notes. Hopper puffed his pipe to life and nodded at Warren Grimes. "Suppose you begin, Warren, and give us a report of your examination of the only decent body we found." Grimes took a clipboard from one of his assistants and studied it for a moment under the glare of a Coleman lantern. "In all my years of experience, I've never seen so many complications in one human. Reddish discoloration of the eyes, both the iris and the whites. Skin tissue an extreme flushed bronze color. Greatly enlarged spleen. Blood clots in the vessels of the heart, the brain, and extremities. Kidneys damaged. Heavy scarring in the liver and pancreas. Very high hemoglobin. Degeneration of fatty tissue. No wonder these people ran amok and ate each other. Put all the disorders together and you could easily produce uncontrolled psychosis."
"Uncontrolled?" asked Eva.
"The victim slowly went mad as the conditions increased, especially damage to the brain, and he eventually went berserk, as evidenced by the signs of cannibalism. In my humble estimation, it's a miracle he lived as long as he did."
"Your diagnostic conclusion?" Hopper probed.
"Death by massive polycythemia vera, a disease of unknown cause whose symptoms are increased numbers of red blood cells and hemoglobin in the circulation. In this case, a massive infusion of red blood cells that produced irreparable damage to the victim's internal systems. And because blood clotting factors were not created in enough amounts for heart stoppage and stroke, hemorrhages occurred throughout the body, becoming especially visible in the skin and eyes. It is as though he was injected with massive doses of vitamin B12, which, as you all know, is essential in the development of red blood cells."
Hopper turned to Eva. "You did the blood testing. What about the cells themselves? Did they maintain their normal flat round shapes with depressed centers?"
Eva shook her head.
"No, they were formed like none I've ever seen before. Almost triangular with spore-like projections. As Dr. Hopper stated, their number was incredibly high. There are roughly 5.2 million red cells per cubic millimeter of blood in the average adult human.
Our victim's blood carried 3 times that number.
Grimes said, I might add that I also discovered evidence of arsenic poisoning, which would have also killed him sooner or later.
Eva nodded. I confirmed Warren's diagnosis. Above normal concentrations of arsenic were found in the blood samples. Also, the cobalt level went off scale.
Cobalt? Hopper straightened in his camp chair.
Not surprising, said Grimes. Vitamin B12 contains almost 4.5% cobalt.
Both of your findings pretty well back the results of my analysis of the community wells, said Hopper. There was enough arsenic and cobalt in a common cup of water to choke a camel.
The underground water table, said Eva, staring into the glow from the heater. The flow must have slowly worked itself through a geologic deposit of cobalt and arsenic.
If I recall my university geology class, Hopper said, thinking back, a common arsenide is nickelite, a mineral often associated with cobalt.
Still only the tip of the iceberg, cautioned Grimes. Both elements combined were not enough to cause this mess.
Some other substance or compound acted as a catalyst with the cobalt and arsenic to push the level of toxicity beyond tolerant bounds and mushroomed the red cell count, one we missed.
And mutated them as well, Eva added.
Not to muddy the mystery any worse than it already is, said Hopper, but something else turned up in my analysis. I found very high traces of radioactivity.
Interesting, Grimes said lukewarmly. But if anything, long exposure to above-normal radiation levels would have lowered the red cell count. I saw nothing during my examination to suggest chronic effects of radioactivity.
Suppose the radiation penetrated the well water only recently, Eva offered.
A distinct possibility, admitted Grimes, but we're still left with the enigma of an unknown killer substance.
Our equipment is limited, Hopper shrugged. If we're looking at a new strain of bacteria or some combinations of exotic chemicals, we may not be able to totally identify the causes here. We'll have to take samples back to our laboratory in Paris.
A synthetic byproduct, Eva murmured thoughtfully.
Then she made a sweeping gesture around the desert.
Where can it possibly come from? Certainly not from around here.
The hazardous waste disposal at Fort Fourreau, Grimes advanced.
Hopper studied the bowl of his pipe.
200 kilometers northwest. A bit far to carry a contaminant against prevailing winds and deposit it in the town wells. And that doesn't explain the high radiation levels. The Fort Fourreau facility is not designed to accept radioactive waste. Besides, the hazardous materials are all burned, so there is no way they could penetrate an underground water supply and then be carried this far without having any deadly chemicals absorbed into the soil.
Okay, said Eva. What's our next step?
Pack up and fly to Cairo and then on to Paris with our samples. We'll take our prime specimen also. Wrap him good and keep him cool, and he should remain in decent shape until we get him bedded down in ice in Cairo.
Eva nodded.
I agree. The sooner we perform our research under proper conditions, the better.
Hopper turned and stared at Batuta, who had said nothing but sat listening, pretending indifference, while a tape recorder under his shirt monitored every word.
Captain Batuta.
Dr. Hopper.
We have decided to push on to Egypt first thing in the morning. Is this agreeable with you?
Batuta flashed a wide smile and twisted one end of his mustache.
I regret I must stay behind and report to my superiors on the plight of the village. You are free to continue to Cairo.
We can't just leave you here.
There is plenty of gas in the vehicles. I will simply take one of the Land Rovers and drive back to Timbuktu.
That's a 400-kilometer trek, you know the way.
I was born and bred in the desert, Batuta said. I will leave at sunrise and be in Timbuktu by nightfall.
Will our change of plan place you in any difficulty with Colonel Mansa? Asked Grimes.
My orders were to serve you, Batuta said patronizingly. Do not give it another thought. I am only sorry I cannot accompany you to Cairo.
That settles it, said Hopper, rising from his chair.
We'll load up our equipment first thing in the morning and take off for Egypt.
As the meeting broke up and the scientists headed for their tents, Batuta lingered by the heater. He switched off the concealed tape recorder and then raised a flashlight and blinked it twice at the cockpit window. A minute later, the chief pilot climbed down the boarding ladder and approached Batuta.
You signaled, he said softly.
The foreign pigs are leaving tomorrow, replied Batuta.
I must radio to Beza and alert them of our arrival. and remind them to give Dr. Hopper and his people a proper greeting. The chief pilot winced knowingly. A disgusting place, Tebeza. Once the passengers are in custody, I don't plan to spend any more time on the ground than necessary.
Your orders are to fly back to the airport at Bamako, said Batuta.
Gladly. The chief pilot made a brief bow of his head.
Good night, Captain.
Eva had taken a short walk to enjoy the clear air and the carpet of stars across the sky. She returned in time to see the pilot walk toward the aircraft, leaving Batuta alone by the heater.
Too compliant and far too eager to please, she mused. There's going to be trouble.
She shook her head as if to cast off the thought.
There you go again with your suspicious female nature.
What can he do to stop them? Once in the air, there would be no turning back. They would be free of the horror and on their way to a more friendly and open society. She took satisfaction in knowing she would never return. And yet, something deep inside, her intuition perhaps, cautioned her not to feel too secure.